The Liberal Party has just taken a huge gamble. In a weakened political position and under pressure from the Nationals, the net zero target is now gone. A game changer that turns the party's fortunes around, or a decision that consigns it to even longer in the wilderness? I'm David Spears. Welcome to Insiders. Over 2 days, the Liberal Party thrashed out a solution to its internal war over climate policy. It was a comprehensive win for Conservatives. Not only is the 2050 net zero target gone as Liberal policy, interim targets could also be watered down, and new coal-fired power plants are being floated as an option. There's a commitment to stay in the Paris Agreement and bring down emissions, but little detail over how. This afternoon, Liberals and Nationals will meet to settle a coalition position, which shouldn't be difficult given they're all basically on the same page. In response, the government has stepped up its defence of net zero, saying the Liberal Party's approach represents climate denial and a recipe for higher prices.
There's nothing like coming back to Canberra.
Morning.
Hey, good morning.
You know where I stand.
Liberal MPs will gather for a showdown over net zero.
Moderates in the party want to keep the target.
We face a choice. We can stand up to be a Liberal Party and fight for the future of this country.
I'm just looking forward to trying to find a middle ground.
While the Conservatives want it scrapped.
Great day for us, I think, to rip this band-aid off, to dump Labor's net zero agenda.
We need to bring down energy prices.
We don't need to choose between high energy prices and lowering emissions.
Yeah, let's get the show on the road.
Confident and conservative.
The opposition within the opposition.
With dueling leadership aspirants behind them.
5 hours later, they emerged.
And one handshake said it all. The Conservatives prevailed.
It's been a good day. It's been a good party meeting.
Very constructive meeting, thank you.
It was an excellent meeting.
And I need to get a run.
I have absolutely no doubt that the party will be able to get behind one policy.
Hello, everyone. Straight there.
You guys are still here.
How was the run?
Energy affordability must come first.
Well, what's good for the planet is good for your pocket.
It is possible for us to unite.
Which is why I argued for cheap, abundant energy today and for scrapping net zero. We'll see what happens. Thanks very much.
All right.
The Liberal Party has dumped net zero. Make no mistake, we're not pursuing net zero. We are pursuing energy affordability and emissions reduction.
But there was very little detail about how it will be achieved.
In many ways, mirrors what the National Party was able to articulate.
Their clown show that they've become.
They look like a bunch of nutters.
I've come as quickly as I can because I heard there's a bit of an emergency here. It's a climate emergency, obviously.
We are committed to the Paris Agreement.
The Paris Agreement is all about net zero.
They fundamentally do not believe in the science in climate change.
The science is settled. What isn't settled is the economics.
The investment in renewables, it's the cheapest form.
Costs just keep going up and up.
Well, let's see how the retail prices are impacted by wholesale prices next year.
I can 100% guarantee that energy prices, power bills will be lower under us.
The coalition approach would hurt Australians.
If there are reasons why people in Paris or in some United Nations organisation don't like it, I can deal with that.
Well said.
Thank you.
My guest this morning is Foreign Minister Penny Wong. First, let's check what's making news. Angus Taylor has given a wide-ranging profile interview to News Corp, laying out the areas he wants to fight on and nominating three fellow Conservatives who should be given bigger roles. He says he spent a lot of time talking to colleagues since losing the leadership to Susan Lee 6 months ago.
We've got to connect what we believe in as Liberals with the challenges and opportunities Australians see in front of them. I think Australians want to see a united Australia where we stand in front of a single flag and we're not divided as a nation.
The Sun Herald has a Resolve poll showing 58% of New South Wales voters believe immigration numbers are too high and only 25% say the current intake is about right. 44% said immigration in recent years has had a negative impact compared to 24% who say it's been positive. The poll did use a relatively small sample size. And finally, the Prime Minister is moving to lock in a security pact with Fiji and resuscitate a security deal with Vanuatu. He's spoken to Nine newspapers about his next steps after landing a new treaty with Indonesia. Well, there were no immediate resignations from the Liberal frontbench after Thursday's decision, but moderates certainly aren't happy. They thought Susan Lee would fight to keep net zero. Instead, they fear the policy they've landed on is utterly confusing. Aside from managing these unhappy moderates on one side, Susan Lee's also facing emboldened conservatives on the other. Angus Taylor's laying out his vision for the party. Andrew Hastie is onto the next big fight, immigration. The opposition leader is apparently unfazed and plans to spend this week selling the new policy before Parliament returns for the final sitting week of the year. Let's see what the panel makes of it. We're joined this week by Jennifer Hewitt, James Masola and Jane Norman. Very good morning to all of you. Let's, Jennifer, start on the policy before we get to the politics. Is it clear where the Liberals have landed? What are they proposing now to bring prices down?
Oh, it's magic, really. Now, we will say, in terms of targets, for example, most countries are not meeting their targets. So the idea that Australia is kind of out of step in a practical sense is not correct, even under the Liberals. But what they are proposing are things like more voluntary actions. They're saying there'll be modest targeted subsidies for all sorts of power, presumably including coal and gas. And, of course, there's the wonderful idea of carbon capture and storage. Much of this is, yes, there'll be bits of it around the edges, but there's absolutely no evidence that this is going to bring down prices. And the same way, there's no evidence that the Labor Party's policies are going to bring down prices either.
Yeah, and we'll come to that because it's, you know, a legitimate concern that people have about power prices, but you would think the coalition is going to need to show how it's going to bring those prices down if that's where it wants to fight. Is there going to be a plan here to subsidise new coal-fired power plants, James? Because I don't know if that was the Dutton policy.
No, I think there's a slight difference, slightly similar but not the same to that, David. I think the idea would be that prospective coal power plants that could be constructed in Australia would have access to finance or government sort of underwriting in the same way that renewables projects do at the moment. So
through the capacity investment scheme.
Exactly. Yep. So someone would have to come to market, come to the minister, come to the government and say, we wish to do this, this is our plan, and presumably if the Liberals are in power, it'd get signed off.
And, of course, that's really not going to happen. There's no interest from the private sector in doing that.
In doing coal.
Yep.
No. Right. Because Dan Tehan talks about new coal plants with carbon capture and storage. Jane, all of that's... These are as expensive as anything, aren't they?
They certainly are. I mean, they're talking about energy abundance. So the idea is to flood the market with cheaper coal and gas. That's the coalition's view. I think at the moment, you look at the situation, we already have states extending the life of coal-fired power stations because they're worried about reliability. So you've got Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, all extending the life of existing coal-fired power stations. We then have a lot of gas beneath the ground, but a great difficulty in extracting it and flooding the market with domestic gas. Narrabri, Beetaloo Basin. So the question really for the coalition is, in the short term, how are you going to bring down prices? Like, what are you going to do to get the Narrabri gas into the market? What are you going to do to extend the coal-fired power stations we have beyond their existing life to bring down power prices in the short to medium term? And that kind of remains the question.
And yeah, this idea about sweating those existing coal assets, you can do that and states are doing that, but presumably for so long.
Exactly. There's only so long you can extend the lives of these power plants. Building new ones costs a heck of a lot more. And during the day when the sun is shining, if the wind is blowing, renewable power is a heck of a lot cheaper than coal-fired power. Like, let's not forget this.
Yeah, and that destroys the business case
exactly.
for the coal-fired power stations.
That's what I was going to ask. Does this scare off investors in renewables or even households, mums and dads, wondering whether to invest in solar and batteries themselves?
Well, I don't think it's going to scare off the idea of households investing in solar panels on their roofs. I mean, that is one of the big success stories, that they really want to do it. But it does make the economics of even, like, large-scale solar farms, for example, much more dubious because everybody's got power in the middle of the day. Yep. So, therefore, prices are very low.
And the advantage of gas, of course, is that you can flick it on and flick it off a bit easier than coal. Once your coal-fired power station's running, you don't turn it off, turn it back on in 10 minutes. It's got to be it's got to consistently be on and working, right? You can get around the problem to some extent by having long-term contracts or agreements to sell coal-fired power from this company, sorry, from this generator to this company, you can have long-term contracts to partially ameliorate that problem, but it does not fully fix the problem.
And of course, the coalition is also talking about nuclear, but that is a long way off.
And they're not talking about taxpayer-funded nuclear plants.
No, the way that not they anymore. Were
just
no.
lifting the moratorium, the letting election. The market.
Yep. Yep. Fun fact on the nuclear plan, Peter Dutton's plan was, well, Labor said, $600 billion or so. To get 10 million households in Australia, $30,000 each to buy solar and batteries would cost $300 billion, like half the price. Now, I'm not saying that's not a lot of money. It's an extraordinary amount of money. But, you know, that's how, in the scheme of things, unaffordable the nuclear plan was.
And then when it comes to the Coalition's plan now to lower emissions, they do want to get rid of existing government plans like the vehicle emissions standard, the penalties that are there under the safeguards mechanism and so on. The question as to what they would do to bring down emissions is a little unclear. Yeah. But the targets that they would set, well, I guess there's also some confusion here as well. Their frontbencher and moderate Andrew Bragg has said they would inherit whatever Labor's targets are and then go further.
Yeah. The Paris Agreement doesn't allow for backsliding, so that would ensure that we are able to make serious headway on emissions reduction.
So the Paris Agreement doesn't allow for backsliding. We can't weaken the targets that are there already. That's not quite what Susan Lee is saying.
No, Susan Lee has said that the coalition in government would set the targets firstly in government, not from opposition, and secondly that they would seek to reduce emissions on average year on year. It's not entirely clear kind of what they'd peg that to, but they have said at a domestic level, if they won the 2028 election, they'd seek to repeal the legislated 2030 target, which is Labor's target, of course.
So repeal it from Australia.
From Australia. Law. Then it's not clear if they would then take a lower target to the UN. I'm told that no country has ever sought to weaken an existing target that they've submitted, and we've now got a 2030 and a 2035 target submitted. It's unclear what would actually happen. Would we be kicked out of the Paris Agreement if we were to try and lower that?
I mean, you can withdraw from Paris, as Donald Trump has done.
But they've made it clear they're staying.
But plenty of countries aren't going to meet their targets. But also, to actually lower your target is a different thing, isn't it?
Well, it is. But look, a lot of this detail will be lost on the public, right? They don't want it. They don't care about those particular details. I mean, I think the far more important part for the Liberals is as Giselle Kapterian, who was the narrowly defeated Liberal candidate. Lost to a Teal. This is a symbol for people, as a proxy for action on climate change. That's what a lot of the Australians want, and they still want it.
Yep.
The challenge for the Liberals is to actually say, yes, you're also very, very focused on the cost of energy, and that is a weakness for the government. That really, you know, remains a weakness. They have to sound convincing that they've got a policy that will deliver lower prices.
Can I just pull up on one of the details I reckon people should get their heads around is this whole, we're out of net zero by 2050, but we're staying in Paris. Paris is a framework for countries to set a trajectory to net zero. Like, you can't not be headed towards net zero, but be in Paris. It doesn't make sense, is it?
Well, a lot of countries are, of course. They're not headed towards net zero, and they are in Paris. There's a lot of rhetoric involved.
But it all comes down to credibility, and the coalition already has a credibility gap on climate and energy. And by saying, yeah, we're sticking with Paris, but not net zero, we're going to set our targets, we don't kind of know what we'll peg that to, I think that just kind of entrenches a perception among voters that they don't really believe in action on climate change. And that is why the moderates were putting such a forceful argument forward to say we need a credible policy, and that means sticking with net zero, because that has become a symbol for action on climate change. Whether or not people actually understand what net zero is, it's, as you say, it's a symbolism of it.
Even whether you stick with net zero by 2050 or not, it was interesting that Tim Wilson, one of the leading moderates in this whole debate, was making the point, at least we've got to set sovereign targets here, not outsource it to the OECD, set our own sovereign targets, which is kind of a conservative argument, I suppose, that we should be in control of what our targets were. Maybe this becomes clearer when the coalition finalised the joint position today. They've got a virtual meeting, a hook-up later this afternoon. It shouldn't be too hard, though. Clearly, they're more or less on the same page. David Littleproud, the Nationals leader yesterday, really boasting about the fact that, you know, it's the Nationals who have dragged the Liberals to this position.
In principle, the Liberal Party's accepted our position on net zero. The mechanics of how we achieve that are really the semantics that we're working through. We can bring forward cogent policy, and we're not subservient to anybody.
They're certainly not subservient to the Liberals on this one or a number of other things. Just on If Susan Lee and her plan is to spend this week and I guess the next couple of years really arguing that this is about lowering prices, can this put pressure on the government? Should they be worried here about an assault on from the coalition aimed at linking net zero to your high power bills?
Well, I think that is an issue, but so far, of course, the Liberals, all they've done is demonstrate a lot of confusion. And you've got to be a kind of feel and sound like a conviction politician to really push that argument. Well, Susan Lee has done the reverse. I mean, it's not as though she's a big believer in anything. She's now decided that the Nationals and then, you know, maybe the Liberals and the Conservatives. So it's very, very hard to push that clear view. The Labor government is vulnerable on prices. There's no doubt about it. But you need to have a very clear and consistent message from the coalition, and there's no evidence of that.
Yeah, and look, the Liberals are right to say emissions have flatlined, mm-hmm. basically, over recent years.
Yes.
They went up a little bit in 2024. Prices, we all know, have just been going up. Chris Bowen is now hinting, I think, that prices may come down next year.
Wholesale prices are a lot lower now than they were in 2022. Let's see how the retail prices are impacted by wholesale prices next year.
Government will be hoping they come down next year, that's for sure. Just want to talk about the politics for Susan Lee, where she's left with all of this, and those powerful images we saw on Wednesday when the party room met. Take a look at this. The Conservatives, that collective of Conservatives there, looking very confident. The way they arranged themselves, walking into the party room, meeting together to fight against net zero. You know, you've got Angus Taylor and Andrew Hastie, the two potential future leaders, the women in the front there, Jess Collins, Sarah Henderson, Jacinda Nupin-Juba Price, the three women that Angus Taylor and The Telegraph is now talking about, people who should be given more prominent roles. And then coming out of the meeting, this handshake moment between Andrew Hastie and another Conservative, James Paterson, job done. What was the significance and the power of these images, Jane?
That the Conservatives are in charge and that they're dictating the terms of the policy debate. So it was the moderates who helped Susan Lee win the leadership a couple of months ago. Now, clearly, the party room has shifted towards the more Conservative side. So we have Angus Taylor and Andrew Hastie in recent days. Interestingly, Angus Taylor doing a very long interview with the Daily Telly, kind of, you know, introducing himself in another way to Australian voters. And we have Andrew Hastie
talking about his favourite movie.
His favourite movie, Devil Wears Prada. Who would have thought? And we have Andrew Hastie on Instagram saying, OK, we've won the debate on net zero. Next, it's immigration. He's a backbencher. And, of course, Susan Lee did mention immigration on Thursday night after the very big shadow ministry meeting to say that was on the radar. But we have basically the Conservatives now dictating the terms of the debate. And while net zero and immigration are the kind of chosen topics, this is all about the future of the Liberal Party and which direction that they go in.
So, we'll come to the immigration debate a bit later, but Conservatives are on the march, moderates are unhappy, bottom line, James, does Susan Lee face a challenge in that final sitting week of Parliament next week?
There's a chance. Yeah, I think it's unlikely. I think it's more likely to happen next year. But we now have a situation, David, where the moderates who installed Susan Lee, her allies, have been let down by the leader, you know, by the woman that they installed. And she's appeased her enemies, you know, in the Conservative faction. They still want her gone. You know, no level of appeasement is going to change their mind.
She's got a big job ahead this coming week to try and show everyone that they're on the right track now. Well, time to talk to the Foreign Minister, Penny Wong. To take us there, here was Susan Lee promising lower power prices than Labor.
It's 2.5 years until the election, Katina. I want to make this point very clear. Those energy bills will be much lower under us. And on the eve of the election, we may be able to give you some further detail, because I'm sure this government's energy policy will have become an ever-increasing train wreck by then.
Penny Wong, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, David.
So you were Australia's first climate change minister, which makes you, I say respectfully, a veteran of the climate wars in Australia. Do you fear the coalition's move against net zero could shift public opinion against this target?
David, what has become of the Liberal Party? I mean, this used to be a serious mainstream political party in this country, and now it is overrun by the fringes. They are trying to outflank Pauline Hanson. And what I'd say to Susan Lee and to Andrew Hastie and to Angus Taylor is you can't be more Pauline than Pauline. But ultimately, what their approach will lead to, their confused, divided approach will lead to, is higher prices for Australians. That's what their approach will mean.
But do you think Australians are seeing prices at the moment going up and up? Their household bills have not yet come down. And wondering whether this approach of the government's is working for them?
We understand people's frustration with energy prices. It's why we've provided relief, which was opposed by the Coalition, to Australians over a number of budgets. It's why we are so focused on bringing more supply into the system. And this is what this is the key issue. The lack of certainty under the Coalition in government and now again under Susan Lee led to a situation when they were in government, of 24 out of 28 coal-fired power stations announcing they would close. That is what happens when you don't have certainty. The market doesn't invest. We saw energy go out of the market, which increases prices. What we are doing is focusing on renewables backed, firmed by batteries, by gas, by hydro, and we are bringing more supply into the system. Last year we saw 5 gigawatts come into the system. That's the approach you have to take to structurally improve the position on prices for Australians.
Just on this argument over the Paris Agreement, What is your understanding? Is it possible to backslide, to weaken the targets that have been submitted?
I think Andrew Bragg is right. You can't backslide on targets that you've agreed to. But again, what I'd say is this. Their approach, Susan Lee, Andrew Hastie, Angus Taylor's approach, will mean higher prices for Australians, it will mean a higher cost for Australians, and it will mean we pay a cost as a country in the region in which we live.
Just on that point, a higher cost in the region in which we live, has there been any reaction that you've picked up from Pacific neighbours about the Coalition's new position?
The Pacific's view of the Coalition's approach to climate policy is well documented, and it became and has become emblematic of the Coalition's disrespect for the Pacific. I mean, that was the case under Tony Abbott, that was the case under Scott Morrison, and regrettably, it is the case under Susan Lee.
So what are you saying, that the view in the Pacific, in the wake of what the Coalition's done this past week, is quite negative?
I am saying that the Pacific regard climate change as their number one issue. So when parties ostensibly of government in our country do this, or make jokes about water lapping at the door, or demonstrate to them that they simply are not prepared to act, what the Pacific take from that is disrespect. Now, we know our prosperity and our security is tied to our region. This just demonstrates again that the Coalition not only would impose higher costs on Australians, but impose a cost on Australia in our region.
Just on those Pacific relationships, what's happened to the security pact with Vanuatu? The Prime Minister's indicating it's, the next priority. It was supposed to be signed a couple of months ago. When do you expect it to be finalised?
The Nakamal Agreement, I think it's important to understand what it is. Nakamal is the place where chiefs come together, leaders come together to talk, to resolve issues, to work out the way forward. That's the spirit of the engagement. So, we will take all the time that is required for that agreement to be finalised. We will work through that with Vanuatu because we want to make sure that whatever agreement is finalised and we enter into, that has the support of both countries' leaders, the parliaments of both countries.
Has it been made more difficult by Vanuatu's decision? It's recently announced it's no longer going to allow foreign security advisers to work in its government buildings, and that includes the police headquarters. Does that make collaboration on security more difficult?
We've been in Vanuatu working with them as a country for decades, and we will do that and have done that in the way that most suits and benefits Vanuatu. That's what a partner does. So we will continue to work with Vanuatu to build capability, to provide development assistance, to help grow their economy, to provide labour movement opportunities in partnership with them.
But physically, not any longer in their government buildings or police headquarters?
Well, we'll work through this with Vanuatu. Obviously, they will continue to seek a partnership and us working with them. We'll do that in the way that works for them.
OK. You're also a bit of a veteran of COP summits too, Penny Wong. Let me ask you about where things are at in terms of Australia's bid to host the climate summit next year. If that's not sorted by the end of this coming week at the current COP summit, what happens? Does Australia drop its bid?
First, just to go back to why we made the we put in this bid for COP. The primary reason we did was to bring the world's attention on what is happening for the Pacific on climate change, the lived reality, the effect on countries like Tuvalu, the effect on countries like Vanuatu. This is the primary reason why we sought the COP, to bring the world's attention to what is happening for our Pacific Island family. Obviously, what the Pacific want for the conference and what Turkey want are very different. So we're going to keep advocating for the Pacific COP. What I would say is this does need to be resolved. Obviously, discussions are ongoing now in Belém in Brazil. Chris is on his way, or he may be there now, and we hope that negotiations will see an outcome.
There's meant to be a final position on this by the end of this this week, by the end of COP meeting. Mm. But again, what happens if it's not finalised? Does it automatically go to Bonn in Germany, or will Australia keep pushing? Will the Prime Minister, for example, take it up with the Turkish President at the G20 summit?
Well, the Prime Minister's looking forward to seeing President Erdogan at the summit. I would anticipate there will be a resolution by the end of the week. And you're right, you know, there is always the default under the rules to Bonn, which I think all the delegates to the conference understand.
Obviously, South Australia wants to host COP, your hometown. But is it true the cost is more than $2 billion?
I'm not going to comment on the costs of a conference that we haven't won the bid for yet.
You don't know the cost? I mean, we're bidding for it.
I think it would also depend on the scope of it, so I'm not going to comment on that, David.
But would that be the sort of price tag Australians should expect?
We're doing this again, where David asked the same question, Penny gives the same answer.
Well, I am. It's a fair question, though, for Australian taxpayers. What would it cost?
And what I'd say to you is I'm not going to provide comment on a conference we haven't yet won. And obviously those costs would be finalised, including with the state government and the scope of the bid.
All right, let's turn to the security treaty with Indonesia signed during the week. How does this benefit Australia's security?
Indonesia is central to Australian security. We know that geographically, we know that historically. And this is an historic agreement that we will enter into a treaty on common security. It means we both recognise that our security is shared, and we make a commitment to one another to consult on broader issues of security, on any potential threats. We make a commitment to cooperate, and we make a commitment that we would take action if we both think is necessary. So this is, again, part of what the government has been seeking to do in times which are turbulent and contested, is to ensure we anchor our security in our region and we strengthen our relationships with regional partners, whether it's Papua New Guinea, where we have a new alliance, Indonesia, or the Pacific, where we are so engaged.
If we're anchoring our security in the region, why then are we expanding, I guess, our security reliance and cooperation with the United States through AUKUS, through greater American access to our bases in Australia and so on? How is that anchoring our security in our region?
There are three aspects to Australia's foreign policy. The region, relationships and the rules. I would also add resilience, but we can discuss that another time. So the region is what we've been talking about. It's why this relationship with Indonesia, this agreement for this treaty on common security is so important. Then there are relationships, and the United States remains our principal strategic partner, and they are indispensable in our region. However, we know we have to do more. You know, we need relationships with India, we need relationships with Japan, we need relationships with Korea. The way we try and maintain peace and security in our region, the way we contribute to that, is through this strategic balance with all of these relationships in our region and beyond contributing.
On the treaty with Indonesia, you mentioned consulting on security threats with each other. I appreciate you probably don't want to get into hypotheticals, but Australians might like to know what's being committed here. If there is a confrontation between Indonesia and China in the South China Sea, is that something Australia would be consulted on?
I don't think the foreign minister is going to, of the country at any time, should be commenting on hypotheticals like that. But what I would say is it is a recognition of a much closer relationship when it comes to instability in our region, that we want to work together for stability and peace.
What about things like greater Indonesian cooperation with Russia in a military sense? Is that something that would be consulted on?
Mm. I'd make a couple of comments about the relationship between Russia and Indonesia. Russia has had a relationship with Indonesia since the time of Menzies. Mm. So I think it's important that we recognise this is not a new set of relationships. We recognise that. We also recognise that the way we deal with our desire for stability is to invest in our relationship with Indonesia, and that is what we're doing. And this is an historic agreement, a treaty which reflects the agreement that Prime Minister Keating was able to establish with Indonesia, which was dissolved in 1999. We now have a version of that, which really brings us back to the high water mark of our relationship.
I guess I'm just trying to get a sense of how it works. So if Indonesia's expanding its cooperation with Russia, or if we're expanding Australia's cooperation with the United States and the presence of US forces here, is that something that has to be consulted on with Indonesia?
I'm not going to get into details of what will and won't be the subject of discussion. Okay. But you will understand it is a different type of relationship that we have both agreed to engage in, which does involve a much more consultation and much more cooperation.
You mentioned cooperation with India amidst that, Penny Wong. You're off to India, as I understand it, this week. There is a bit of a question mark right now over the future of the Quad grouping, India, Japan, Australia and the United States. It was meant to be a leaders' meeting in India this year. It's not happening. Where are things at with the Quad? Is this going to last?
First, I'm very pleased to be heading to India this week to see my very good friend, Minister, External Affairs Minister Jai Shankar. India's a really important partner, really important power in the world and in our region. It's a great power in the world. Look, in terms of the Quad is very important to Australia, and the extent of its importance is demonstrated by the fact I've been to two foreign minister level meetings of the Quad this year in the United States, and that really is a demonstration that the Quad partners understand the importance of that meeting, of that set of countries to stability in our region. Now, we obviously look forward to there being a Quad meeting of leaders when leaders are able to do that.
Two quick ones, finally. China is demanding a retraction after ASIO boss Mike Burgess claimed that two cyber hacking groups trying to penetrate critical infrastructure here in Australia were, in his words, working for Chinese government intelligence and their military. Was Mike Burgess right?
We always take the advice of our security agencies, intelligence agencies, very seriously and very carefully, and we back them. And what I would say is, the risks of cyber intrusion, the risks of foreign interference are not new risks. We know about these. We understand these. That's why we are seeking to make sure we are more resilient. We have increasing cyber protection, and we act with other countries to attribute cyber intrusions when is appropriate.
So
when
that's appropriate. You agree that this should be attributed to China?
Oh, we have acted with other countries to attribute a number of PRC-linked entities to cyber intrusions. We did that over, earlier this year.
Okay.
So we will do that as necessary.
Final one, the Trump administration's lifting tariffs on a bunch of products, including beef, bananas, coffee. Certainly for Australian beef farmers, that sees that tariff come off. There has been a backlash over grocery prices in the US leading up to this decision. Is this a case of I told you so when it comes to these Trump tariffs, and do you expect more now to be removed?
We welcome the lifting of these tariffs. That's a good thing for Australian beef producers. We maintain a clear, consistent position. We do not support tariffs. We believe in being able to access each other's markets. We think that's in the best interests of consumers as well as of producers. What I would say, though, is this does demonstrate again, the where the opposition have been on this. And I would again make this point. It's possible to be a decent opposition and still back the country. And it'd be good if they actually did that.
Okay, but when it comes to Donald Trump, is this the first crack on the tariffs? Do you expect the aluminium and steel ones to come off next?
Look, we will keep advocating our position. We think there is very clear economic logic to that. And we've made that position clear. The Prime Minister made it clear in his discussion with Mr. Trump, President Trump.
Foreign Minister Penny Wong, thanks for joining us this morning.
Always good to speak with you, David.
All right, coming up, we are going to have a look at that Indonesia security treaty that was signed during the week. First, let's get back to our panel, Jennifer Hewitt, James Masola and Jane Norman. Just on the tariffs there, Jennifer, this there's a phrase called Tucko Trump. Trump always chickens out. Is that what's happened here in relation to these bunch of food tariffs that he's removed?
Yes, well, Donald Trump may still say that tariffs are his favourite word, but, of course, the favourite concept for Americans is cost of living. And I think the recent elections, made it very clear to the White House that those tariffs were having a very bad effect on the Republican and Trump's popularity. So, yes, this is definitely a case of Tucko.
Just coming back to a couple of other things we heard from the Minister there, James, when it comes to the Coalition's net zero position, Penny Wong pointing to the Pacific here as well. It hasn't really come up much in the debate this week, but it is a factor here, isn't it? How does this position us regionally if we were seen, at least, to be watering down action on climate change?
It absolutely is a factor. And if you think back to the first sort of 12 to 18 months of Anthony Albanese as Prime Minister, David, he spent a lot of time travelling around the Pacific. Obviously, the 43% legislation, emissions reduction, one of the first bills that the government passed. And he did that because the government believed, relationships needed to be repaired. And having a credible climate policy is the price of entry. And, you know, some of those Pacific leaders didn't think that that was the case, that we were in that position with Scott Morrison.
And just on the COP bid, the climate summit for next year, Jane, Penny Wong expects it to be sorted this week one way or another. I don't think there's a great deal of hope that Turkey will finally blink on this, but no mention of what the price might be should we be hosting it here.
No, that's right. And this kind of goes to questions of the level of enthusiasm within the government to actually win this bid. So we're deadlocked with Turkey. The only way it's resolved is if one of the parties pulls out. There's no sign of that happening. I mean, it might, like everything's, I guess, in the air, but it's looking pretty slim at this stage. And that means the conference defaults to Bonn. But yeah, there are big questions about whether we want to spend $2 billion on this, whether the government wants its 2026 agenda to be effectively all about hosting this COP bid.
Think about the politics for a moment. If it were here next year in Adelaide, up to three weeks of people talking, if the bill is anything like the amount of money you're talking about, to Jane's point, we spend half a year talking about climate change, the number one issue next year is going to be the same as the one it is now, which is cost of living. So if, you know, they're spending $2 billion or whatever it is on the summit while everyone's at home saying, I can't pay my electricity bill or do the grocery shopping, it is madness.
And also there'd be the whole argument, there'd be lots of all the demonstrations all demanding an end to the oil and Australia's oil and gas experts and things. It's not really something that the government would look forward to from that point of view, no matter what Chris Bowen says. I think the more interesting point is now, Bonn doesn't want this. So does Australia... And Turkey, apparently, President Erdogan's wife is very, very keen on having it. And, you know, given a choice between Albanese and his wife, clearly President Erdogan, I'm sure there are other reasons, but has made the decision to keep on going. The question, I guess, for the Australian government is it better, therefore, to go to quietly withdraw and say we did all we could? We really tried, but it's not a good idea for it to go to Bonn. Yeah. I don't know.
Look, maybe. But I think coming back to the Pacific, this is something we've done with the Pacific as a joint bid. I think that's the big reason why Australia is pretty keen to do this.
And that was the emphasis the Foreign Minister was putting on, right? She wasn't really talking about Australia so much as this is about the Pacific bid. And it's like, well, it's a joint bid, of course, but her emphasis sort of, went to that.
I mean, look, everyone's been pointing to the deadline has to be the end of this week when this current COP in Brazil finishes. I just wonder whether it might still drag on a little beyond that before we get a final
answer. You know, behind the scenes, there's a whole task force that's been set up in Australia because, as a former diplomat, David Dutton, said, this is the biggest and most complex diplomatic undertaking that Australia would ever undertake, and we have people who are working on this behind the scenes because they've got 12 months to pull this off if indeed Australia succeeds. So there's kind of like active work going on
It is also a kind of a counter to Chinese influence. It's one of the government's main strategies to, you know, talk about Australia as a more reliable partner for many of those Pacific
countries. The other final point... sorry, Jenny. The other point, or the thing to consider, Turkey has a much bigger population than Australia, is more of a kind of a laggard, if you like, in reducing emissions. getting Turkey or awarding it to Turkey would then put pressure on them to come further into the tent in terms of reducing emissions. And that's a, you know, an economy with 80 million people or 100 million.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Let's turn to the security treaty with Indonesia. This would have been the big news of the week had the coalition not been at each other over net zero. Here is the Indonesian President Prabowo Subianto.
I mentioned many times that we cannot choose our neighbours, especially countries like us. It is our destiny to be direct neighbors. So let us face our destiny with the best of intentions.
Indonesia is famously non-aligned. This is not an alliance, but it is a security pact or a security treaty. And it is a big deal, James. Yep. You're a former correspondent there.
Yep.
What do you make of it? Why has it been done now?
Look, it is significant. It's not a formal alliance, as you say, like with New Zealand or the United States. Having lived there for a couple of years, it never failed to shock me how little we knew about Indonesia and vice versa. So anything, I think, first of all, first principles, anything that brings our two peoples together to cooperate in this sphere, I think, is welcome. This is not a sort of a treaty whereby, say, a war started with Taiwan, between Taiwan and China. Australia got sucked into it. It would not suck in Indonesia. Mm. But conversely, and you touched on this with Penny, you know, were there to be an incident in the South China Sea, Australia would get Indonesian information or intelligence, whatever you want to call it, and potentially weigh in. And similarly, if you know, Chinese warships are going through the Straits of Malacca or wherever it might be on their way here, we might find out a bit sooner through Indonesian sources. So it's sort of a grounding, if you like, rather than a finished product.
I mean, the minister's not wanting to spell out exactly what would be discussed, but you would think things like, you know, if Russia, as there was all that speculation before the election, suddenly wants to base warplanes in Indonesia, that's something we'd want to talk about, right?
Yes. No, I think, yes, just increased cooperation and arrangement. I think it's a very good thing. I find it hard to imagine that anybody would think other than this is a strengthening of our relationships in the region for good purposes and that it's a necessary thing to do.
Think about it in this frame too. Like in the 1963 election, Sir Robert Menzies campaigned hard on the need for Australia to get the F-111 fighter bombers because of that threat from Indonesia to the north. It's 2 years later, and they're now a sort of a strategic partner, and no one thinks about, you know, oh, are we going to go to war with Indonesia? I mean, it's just not in prospect, and it hasn't been for decades.
I mean, as Penny Wong touched on, this takes us back really to the agreement that Paul Keating put in place that ended when we helped out East Timor. But it's a very different environment now to the Keating years with China's strength in the region, its military and economic strength in the region. So why is Indonesia doing this now? It also has a difficult relationship at times with China.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't look like this has been triggered by necessarily any one event, but I think you can look at the kind of web of treaties that Australia has been signing in recent times.
And Indonesia.
And Indonesia, right? So you've got, obviously, from Australia's perspective, PNG, Indonesia, the government's still trying to pursue the Vanuatu Agreement. He's talking about Fiji now. And this is basically all about hedging against an increasingly assertive and expansionist China in the region. Indonesia is famously unaligned. I think their motto is like 1,000 friends and zero enemies. So we're not sort of looking like this is not sort of an alliance, but it is a very interesting moment in time where we have an increasingly assertive China and a lot of concerns in the region. But going back to the Paul Keating era agreement, that was about Indonesia having concerns about China's incursions into the South China Sea.
Yeah.
Still happening. Still but happening. Of course, we've got a very different Beijing.
Prabowo is fascinating, though. I mean, remember when Trump was re-elected, he had that fawning phone call that he videoed and posted on social media. He then pops up with Xi Jinping at the big military parade in China as well, standing alongside Kim Jong-un and
friends
so on.
Friends with everyone.
Friends with everyone.
He's a very different president to Jokowi's predecessor, who was a furniture maker who was very successful in business, rapidly rose. He's a consummate, Prabowo is a consummate insider. Former son-in-law of President Suharto.
That's right, yeah.
Former Special Forces. He was banned from entering America because of allegations of war crimes.
And his image is really softened, right?
Yes. Like, it has, but Jokowi was actually remained very, very popular inside Indonesia. Prabowo is less so.
Yeah, he's got a program to reduce stunting, you know, people not having, kids not having enough food and, you know, not growing to their proper height. It's billions of dollars over cost, and it's not working. And yeah.
By the way, he's also got a big concern about climate change because they're relocating their capital city and building a seawall around Jakarta. They've got a real problem there when it comes to those issues.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about immigration, because this, as the Conservatives and the Liberals are flagging, is the next big thing. In fact, Andrew Hastie, the other night after the win on Net Zero, told his followers, sent a message to them, objective one done, objective two, cut Labor's uncontrolled immigration. This reform needs to happen and will be the next debate. I mean, Susan Lee's already talking about this being the next priority, immigration, but a more nuanced tone.
So I have said it needs to be lower. I've also said the problems we're facing are not the fault of any migrant or migrant community. They are failings of infrastructure.
So this is about infrastructure. We need to spend more, I guess, on infrastructure, but also lower the immigration number.
Well, I noticed that she was being very careful there because, of course, what party wants to do at the moment is to offend the very large groups of immigrants in Australia, particularly the Indian community, the Chinese community. Australia has the highest, there's no doubt, has the highest immigration as a percentage of population in the world. And so there's general support for curbing it. Of course, the details of how to do that are much more kind of complicated. Mm. But so I think she's going to be wanting to give double messages there. Oh, it's nothing about we've got too many immigrants coming in, really. It's all about the infrastructure. But you can't really do that. In the end, they're going to have to cut, and probably student numbers and backpackers. But in terms of the core skills, I was amazed to realise that certainly needs tightening up. If you could look at the list, who knew? Goat farmers, apiarists and flower growers are on the core skills list. That just seems bizarre to me.
We need more goat farmers. But when it comes to what's happening with net overseas migration, which is, the big measure of what's happening, here, have a look. You can see how it did dip during COVID and then it spiked post-COVID. It has been coming down over the last year or so, heading back to more normal levels. But I guess it's that peak that we saw that people are still experiencing, Jane, and you see that in all the polling, don't you, that this still comes up as a big priority for a lot of voters.
Because, I mean, I would argue that the Coalition hasn't necessarily made the case for dumping net zero and power price grounds. When it comes to immigration, there's decades-long sensitivities in Australia to migrant numbers, and I think Australians want to see a controlled migration system, so they have faith in it. But you even hear from independents like Di Lee in Western Sydney, who will say that we need to be very cautious about migrant numbers, because in her electorate, there was a huge intake of, of refugee intake or migrants, and she said that has put enormous pressure on houses and congestion. Like, they've got very congested roads now. And so it's something that Australians sort of see and feel very sharply. And
I think Susan Lee's right to say, you know, the tone that you have around this debate really matters. Because we saw when Jacinda Nupager-Price made those comments about Indian migrants, just the extraordinary and understandable backlash. They do need to be very careful about how they approach this debate. And James, when it does come to lowering numbers... Yeah. It's easier said than done because, I mean, Peter Dutton was promising big cuts but said, oh, we'll work out how after the election. In government, we'll tell you how.
Yep, and this is the thing. Parts of the... It's very difficult to cap parts of the migration program, the net overseas program. So, for example, family reunions, are you going to stop those? I mean, there's already a big backlog. Or are you going to cap those at a certain number so some people get to bring their wife or husband overseas or their kid from overseas or their kids and others don't? Like, it's not... quite as simple as it's being fixing this as it's being portrayed at the moment, David.
And if you do, for example, target working holiday makers, backpackers, they're very popular in the regions because these are the people... What are farmers going to do? Like, these are also the people who are doing the jobs that Australians don't actively or enthusiastically take up, like picking fruit. And so that's really been factored into the business model for a lot of regional communities.
Well, and also factored into the business model for universities, of
Precisely.
Course, as being international students. I think that that has gone completely... I think most Australians think that's now out of control. But, of course, the universities say, well, where else are we going to get the money from? And it's certainly not coming from Canberra.
Just quickly, Nauru, we have an arrangement now, pretty expensive one, $400 million and then $70 million a year to send the so-called NZYQ cohort over there. Nauru's president made an unannounced visit, popped in the side door of Parliament House during the week. What's going on there,
Jen? Yeah, so my colleague, Stephen Jetjets, just saw the car with the Nauruan flag at the Senate entrance, which is not the typical entrance for a leader to be entering. But after a few inquiries, we learned that David Adeyang, who was in town for a big kind of regional conference the night before, was meeting with Foreign Minister Penny Wong and Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke. We know that they've met. We have no idea what they talked about. And it just kind of like goes to the secrecy surrounding the massive deal that Australia has signed with Nauru to take the hundreds of basically non-citizens that we're sending there under the NZYQ cohort. We don't know how much it's costing. We have Senate estimates suggesting it's $2.5 billion. Reports last week in the Nine newspaper suggested that some of that money that Australia is spending is now being funneled to bikie gangs. So a lot of questions about this deal, which we don't know anything about, we never hear about.
It's always been the way, though.
So it has always been the way, going right back to the Howard years. And so it's just a continuation of that theme.
Now, we always own our own mistakes. And on last week's program, we showed a brief image of Senator Jane Hume holding a newspaper in our montage package about the coalition's internal woes. In an attempt at satire, the image of the Prime Minister on the newspaper was altered to show coalition figures instead. We acknowledge the edit should have been clearer to you, our audience, and we apologise to Senator Hume for the mistake. Let's get some final observations. Jane.
An update on the Tomago smelter, Australia's biggest aluminium smelter. It's facing closure after 2028 because of rising power prices. There's a lot happening behind the scenes. The government's determined to keep it going. Two things that are happening. Chris Bowen's department is actively looking at the possibility of a power purchase agreement with the government-owned Snowy Hydro scheme, so that would potentially help beyond 2028. The second thing that's happening is that the government is actively considering a proposal that's been put forward by people like Oliver Yates, and that is for the government itself to start signing long-term power purchase agreements with renewables developers at the start of the process. That would reduce the risk for renewables, but it also enable the government to then on-sell those contracts at a more competitive price to big industrial users like Tomago. So these are some ideas being kicked around, and it has led to a bit more optimism from insiders about the future of this smelter.
Very interesting. James?
I want to give a shout-out to a poll that we ran in The Age and the SMH a day or so ago, looking at King Charles, Prince Andrew and the
former
Prince Andrew. I'm still and just how significant it was. So 43% of Australians now support a republic. Only 28% opposed. That's like the biggest gap we've seen in I think, well, as long as we've been polling and resolve. 60% of Australians want Andrew out of the line of succession. Between September and November, the 2 months, you know, the start of the scandal, the end of the scandal, King Charles, I almost said Prince's, King Charles's approval went up 12 net points to 25, and Andrew is on 13 percentage points, just 8 behind Vladimir Putin. So maybe Anthony Albanese was a bit hasty in getting rid of his Minister for the Republic.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, good point, Jennifer.
Well, do we all remember Jim Chalmers' economic reform roundtable? Not really. Not much came out of it, particularly on tax reform. But one thing that did come out was the Productivity Commission wanting a net cash flow tax, not net zero, net cash flow tax. Very complicated, but the bottom line is business absolutely hates it. Its final report is due in a few weeks. Will, in fact, Jim Chalmers bury it quietly and just admit the whole thing has just kind of gone into really nothing much, or will he try and push the boundaries?
Yeah, it's good to put that on the radar because, that final report will be interesting reading. Thank you all very much for joining us this morning. Finally, even the Oscars has made the ultimate awards night blunder of reading out the wrong winner. But the only thing worse than getting it wrong is getting it wrong twice. We'll leave you with Friday night's award for the Senior South Australian of the Year. Thanks for watching.
Malcolm Benoy.
There's been a controversy.
The wrong winner was in the envelope, and we do apologise for that. The 2026, a Senior Australian of the Year, is in fact...
James. Is it James?
It is James.
James Curry.
We had it right all the way along. I don't know what has transpired behind the scenes, but it's incorrect information. It is Malcolm Benoy. I'm terribly sorry for the embarrassment.
You're making us all feel very excited about being here.